Good evening, and this is an interview for the Michigan Writers Series, Friday, October 18th, 2002. I'm speaking with Joseph Matuszek, whose poems, essays, and stories have been published in numerous journals and anthologies, and who also has a couple of full-length poetry collections in the works. Welcome to MSU, Joe.
Thanks, glad to be here.
You are the former director of ArtsWire, a program of the New York Foundation for the Arts, and you have an extensive history as a technology consultant focusing in nonprofit concerns. What does that entail, and how did you get started in that line of work?
Oh, well, mostly what it entails, I think, is asking big, stupid questions over and over again, like, what are you trying to do, and why would anyone want to bother with this, which are questions that lots of times people haven't actually asked themselves. How I got started in it is a kind of odd, I guess, conflagration of interests, basically. Mm-hmm. I've always been interested in technological stuff. I ran one of the very early bulletin board systems in this region, you know, back in the early 1980s on an old VIC-20 computer, which if you even remember those.
Probably from elementary school.
Yeah, exactly. I spent about 5 years or so being manager of a computer store. That was my one foray into the for-profit world. I've also always been interested in, you know, the arts, and have had various, you know, connections with running organizations or being part of organizations. And basically what happened was I was actually at Ragdale Colony in Lake Forest, Illinois, on a writing retreat when I was the director of Buckham Fine Arts Project in Flint. And I got there, and I hadn't really talked to anybody for quite some time when I got back. And the president of my board said, you have to go to D.C. to this conference. And it turned out to be the National Association of Artists Organizations conference right at the time that the NEA4 stuff was hitting the fan.
So
it was a very contentious, very interesting conference. I hadn't talked to anybody for basically about a month and a half, and I jabbered my fool mouth off while I was there and walked into this organizing meeting of this thing called ArtsWire and discovered that I basically said at some point, I'm sorry, this is all very interesting, but you don't know what you're talking about, and walked away from the conference on kind of their planning committee and on the board of NAO. So that was, and the rest was sort of one big long accident.
It was just happenstance. Yeah. Okay. Well, this past summer you
Dumb luck is a kind of theme of my life, I think. So the dumber the better.
Well, this past summer you served as an artist in residence on a community knowledge project at the Clinton Township Library, where you live. Please tell me about that.
Well, that's a project that's actually still kind of in process. And the idea, I mean, even though it's officially ended, the grant period has officially ended. The project has several more years to go to really come to fruition. Part of it actually comes out of doing projects with the Creative Writers in the Schools program in Michigan. And the last probably decade or so of doing that, one of the things I always did is try to have like a community connection thing where the kids would work, have the kids work with like retirees or go out into the community. And largely because it's a really cheap way to get kids stimulated. You know, you take them with a bunch of retirees and you say, okay, here's what I want you to ask them. Ask them what their favorite video game was when they were kids. Okay. Ask them what their favorite television show was when they were kids. Ask them what kinds of things they did. And, you know, they get there and the seniors are all, what do you mean video games? I don't even know what a video game is now. You know, television, we didn't have television. We had horses, you know. Before long, the kids are like, you know, were there dinosaurs wandering around? Well, on a couple of those occasions, there were just very unique stories that came up. I was doing one along the St. Clair River in a school there, and one of the gentlemen, the retirees, was talking about being on the St. Clair River in the middle of the winter when they were pulling up a Model T or Model A sedan that had fallen through the ice. This was during World War II, and he was a young, in his early teens. And, you know, these were people who were smuggling things from Canada into the United States because there was rationing going on in World War II. And what he remembers is all the townspeople reaching across these dead bodies to get these frozen blocks of butter out of this. And I thought to myself, you know, there's only a few places where that could have actually happened. And here's a guy who's in failing health and elderly, and that story is going to disappear when he does.
Yeah.
How can we capture this? So my project is kind of a community knowledge and mapping project where literally it attempts to map every single building and every single organization that's in the community with the long-term idea of mapping all the stories and collecting all the stories and all the information as well to kind of get a sense of what the place actually is, that it's not only the menus that are available in the restaurants or the, you know, the zoning pieces and things like that, but it's, you know, what happened at so-and-so's wedding, and it's the stories of that, both past, present, and future. So that's the idea behind it. It's all done electronically using a big database online, and it still doesn't work as nicely as I would like to yet. And and the truth of it is that it's going to take several years to actually fill the information in. But it's been a fascinating thing to learn what people are interested in and what their agendas are. For example, the historical society there, I never would have thought this would be their like their main thrust, but their main thrust is to get all of the obituaries digitized.
Not the
photographs, not the big stories. No. Why? Because people...
They tell the life stories.
They're about genealogy. That's what people come and look for. And the township there has a very similar... That's one of their top three agendas as well, because they're in charge of keeping track of who's in what cemetery plot. It's like the same kind of thing. And that's not what I would have thought. I would have thought, okay, you know, the Historical Society, they've got all this great information about the stories of the various, you know, events and businesses and people. No, it's just obituaries because that's what people want. And, you know, so it's been a great learning experience. And the next part of the process is really activating the various groups and working with them on a much more concrete basis. This has been about kind of creating the scaffolding for everything to fit in and figuring out what would all this look like to hold all this stuff. And I wish I'd never started it. It's really, I thought, okay, it's 2,500 people. How, you know, that's the right size. No, there's like 2,500 organizations. It's like, can't you people all just be in one organization? I mean, it's just it's amazing the depth and the layering, even in a small community, the multiplicity of options and things that people do. It's just fascinating to really look at. And in many ways, that's fine, because I think the core question underneath the whole project was, what's in a community? I just didn't expect there was that much.
Well, it sounds really fascinating. Did your newer poem, The Retiree, come out of the experience of bringing the retired?
No, actually that came out of my mother's complaint that I'd never written a poem for her. Which she was made loud and often. And I said, it's not like I'm like a super happy poet. I'm not sure you want to be looking for that, but you know. So I tried for years and years and years and years, and finally I started thinking that the function of my mother is basically to annoy her children. So that's what
calling
the poem
the
is about.
Okay, I was wondering about that. I thought it's rather humorful.
Well, I have a few, but it's not like...
Well, speaking of your poetry, publication of your collection Eating Fire by Ridgeway Press has been held up because, as you told me, conflict over the cover art. Could you please explain that one?
Well, I've been using this excuse for a long time, and it's actually true. But I should also say that just plain inability to move towards closure is also one of the themes of my life. I don't like to finish things, it seems. But in truth, a lot of the delay originally was there was a cover that I just fell in love with, and I really wanted this cover. And at Buckham Gallery in Flint, there was a show put on years ago, which was a series of doors and doorways, and it was all artists reacting to Tiananmen Square on its anniversary. And at that time, an artist or a student who was, I believe, at Wayne State University doing PhD work, who was one of the student leaders, came up and spoke and showed some slides. And he left a photograph of tanks burning in Tiananmen Square. And it was taken out of his mother's apartment window. And so it was like, this has never been published, no one's ever seen it. And one of the artists there, John Dempsey, who used to work for book design and printing corporation, now teaches at Mott Community College, manipulated the photograph so that it was kind of be skewed so that you couldn't really tell what angle it was taken from, and cropped it and did a really, really nice thing with it. I really liked it. I just saw that as the cover, since I do have at least a mild political bent in my work. But then we could never track down the student, the guy who took it.
And permission.
Yeah, and everyone was bothering me, and they were like, just do it, you know? It's different, it's been changed, it's not a problem, won't be. And all I could think of is, you know, of the secret police bursting into some mother's apartment because, you know, they could identify the angle of the photograph. So it was like, you know, psychically, how that would just, even if it never happened, having that kind of hangover top of it just made it impossible. And I have to say that I got so obsessed with the thing. I mean, that we went through all this stuff trying to track the guy down. Even if he'd have said no, it would have been closure, but it was just sort of floating. So I've had a couple of other things since, and nothing that's really completely blown me away in the same way. And at this point, it's just like, okay, idiot, get it done with and get it out. And I will probably once I come back from Thailand. So
okay. So sometime next year, hopefully.
Yeah, it's time for closure since I've long since stopped futzing with the thing. It's been set in stone for quite some time.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I noticed that when you sent me the manuscript. Now there's a very strong narrative order to the poems. And you've divided them into three sections titled Fuel, Flame, and Exhale. And I was wondering what you had in mind when you divided the poems up that way.
Oh, gosh. I think in a real sense, I think what I was looking at are the different aspects of how life is driven, you know, and how we react to it. And that there are certain things that really kind of stimulate us, and that perhaps come early on in the process of becoming who we are, and then there are the things that just kind of obsess us in some ways that we burn about, as it were, and then finally there are the issues of either exhaustion or loss or however it would be, regret.
Well, I read the poems in the section titled Exhales, most of them being about acceptance of one kind or another, acceptance of the past.
To the extent that I believe in acceptance, which as opposed to, you know, I'm not sure I think of it as I tend to be against closure on principle, and I don't like neat packages.
Okay.
I think one of the recurring themes in my work is some degree of retention of tension, how would I say it? Maybe resolution, but distrust of the resolution. Some sort of tension there. So yeah, I think acceptance underneath that, or trying to grapple with acceptance on some level or another, is, it's still a theme, but I don't know that I still believe it.
Okay. Well, religious imagery is certainly abundant in your poems.
Good little Catholic boy.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I knew that right away.
Yeah.
particularly the title poem, Eating Fire, but also The Loss of Teeth and Dreams, The Wolf at the Door, Avenger, Rapture, Ash. All of them combine elements of the sacred and the profane, and all of them, to some degree, I write as conveying a reconciliation between the faith of your childhood and whatever faith it is you have now as an adult.
Yeah, which is not the faith of my childhood.
It's changed.
I would say that in some ways, I think it's an acceptance that it's that you can't escape from the kind of metaphors that have been pounded in your head since you're a kid, and that whether my belief system is exactly the same or not, those images still resonate, and the whether I believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible in the way that I might have as a kid or that I was taught, the fact of that doesn't mean that the stories still don't resonate, that they don't have sort of metaphorical and mythical power. And I think that's very much the case. I mean, it's the language I was taught, shall we say. So, of course, I use it.
Well, I was wondering if you're more of a metaphysicist now. In the poem Knee, you say that, this is your religion. I mean, the body, the temporal, elemental. I mean, what you can see. Touch,
actually, I think I'm the opposite.
Really?
I think I would classify myself as an animist. Increasingly, trees are God. That's my take these days.
Okay.
Is that the things are bounded in cycles that happen because they happen, as opposed to because they have meaning. Increasingly, I think that's true. And I think part of what I grapple with is the issue of how do you find meaning in something. In something that isn't particularly a kind of classical sense of meaning, where the meaning is that it is, as opposed to the meaning is a specific liturgical approach.
Okay.
So, which probably explains why I'm heading off to Thailand. Because the Buddhism is essentially animism at its core.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, several of your poems are love poems, if you will, and the subject of them is sitting here with us, with Josie, or the subject of some of them, I suppose. Okay. Well, last November, your wife, poet Josie Kearns, read here. You even joined her in reading her poem, Hystra. I asked her this question, so now it's your turn. Is it challenging to have two writers, two poets, living under the same roof, and do you ever help one another at all with your writing?
Yes, it is challenging, always challenging, simply because we work extremely differently. What we're interested in is very different. Our approach is very different. The way we think about it is very different. I happen to think that while that's challenging, that's also very, very useful. I constantly learn from her approach. I constantly think, well, that works, but why would anyone want to do that? And I look at it and I say, well, okay, because it does this. I mean, and it's very useful for me just to see how she, turns the things around her into art. It's very different from the way that I do it. And I think constantly having a new stimulus of how to work and challenging your assumptions is a good thing. And I think we've come to kind of an accommodation of our different ways of working. So we know that we don't work the same. We know that we're, no matter how much we might think, well, that's an idiotic way of doing it. Well, it works for you, so whatever, I guess that's one piece. And now what was the second part of the question?
Do you ever help one another?
I think we don't do it as much as we used to.
Oh, okay.
In that, we were part of a writing workshop for a long, long time, and we still do it, but it's not as close a textural read. We used to use each other very much more concretely for kind of editing purposes, where it would be really close order, get rid of this and rearrange that. I don't think we do. We do some of that, but we don't do as much of it as we used to. I would say now more, it's a more structural kind of thing or thematic kind of thing, where we'll say, I like this, but have you thought about this piece here that might either need to, I don't think this is highlighting what you're doing in the same way, or I think maybe there's something different here, or this makes me think of this. So I think what's different about it is that, I mean, at this point, we know that each other can write. We know that we have the chops, and that if it really comes down to it, I have in my head already the kinds of close textural criticisms that she will give.
Mm-hmm.
I know how she looks at pieces because we've done it for so many times. Yeah. So I can apply that template kind of in advance, as it were. But what I don't necessarily have still is, you know, the perspective and the insight coming at it. So on that level, we do it. I would say it's a good deal less intense than it used to be, where, you know, we don't sit down and, you know, just mark each other's poems up and rip them up to the same level that we used to. We still do it occasionally, but it's just not as often. I think some of it is that we're a little better at it after all these years than we were when we were doing that stuff before. Good. Hopefully, at least.
Thanks. Well, this series is called Michigan Writers, so we inevitably ask our guests what living in Michigan has brought to their writing. Now, trying to place this within the context of your poems, I saw in Miscarriage you allude to Michigan as a place of manufacture and layoff that you want to leave for Ireland, although I think there are other reasons why you want to escape Michigan then as well. But the opening lines of Twister present an overview of a rather vacuous land. So this is the Midwest, and this, and this, everywhere, mind sputtering on the edge of an important thought. Do you feel as negative about this place as the words?
Well, I mean, I think yes and no. I mean, I love the place. It's where I am. Anything that I say about it that way, I include myself. I'm part of the landscape. So, you know, my mind is
kind of... Well, I know you're not looking down.
Yeah, no, it's very much an issue of, you know, how I wish my mind would get to that thought once in a while, too. You know, it's... but I do feel, in many ways, that and I'm certainly not the first one to say it, that there is a degree of blandness about the way that we go about things. And there is... in some ways, that's extremely wonderful and good. In some ways, it can be frustrating at times because it's not as challenging, perhaps, as hanging around, you know, the art cafes in New York or San Francisco, if I wanted to go that way. I do feel, you know, I grew up in Flint. I came through the school system right at the end of the great manufacturing boom when everything was starting to contract. And to be perfectly honest, the school system there essentially presumed that unless you were a felon, you were going to go work in the shops.
Yeah.
And so when you got to be in high school, which is right when I went through, and all of a sudden that wasn't an option, it was kind of like, oops, sorry, go fend for yourself. And what it manifested was generations upon generations of people who really didn't need to think about what to do with their lives. And who had never really been taught the process of how to think about their lives, how to make decisions about it, because there was always this default thing to make $50,000 a year once you pop the overtime in. You know, whether no matter what your philosophy was, no matter what your personal underpinnings were, it didn't really matter because you were just going to go in there anyway. It was sort of you were just sort of grist for the mills, as it were. So I think to some extent I do react to that.
Yeah.
In that the great helplessness that followed that and that still periodically follows, you know, based on the swings and the positives and negatives of the manufacturing activity around the automotive industry, I do react to. I mean, I think in some ways, you know, there should be more than that. There's more to us than sticking a bolt in a car door, even if that's what we do, and there should be a support process for that as well. That, I guess that's what I'm reacting to. But no, I mean, I'm a Midwest kid. I'm anywhere I go, I'm from Flint. Okay, and which, you know, as I'm fond of saying, means I can go anywhere because it's always safer.
That's true. Well, we've got to wrap this up, so I want to just quickly talk about what writing projects you're currently working on and what you're going to be doing in Thailand.
Well, my Thailand trip is a writing retreat, and I have several projects that I'm working on. One thing I want to try while I'm there is a completely different way of writing. I usually start from a concept and go into the concrete and go into the narrative. One of the things I want to try over there is to start with a kind of what's around me slice of life and see if I can go in the opposite direction, just to see if I can. I've never written that way, and there are lots of people who do, but it's not something I've ever even tried, to be perfectly honest. So I want to see if I can do it. The other thing that I'm actually very interested in is I have spent a great deal of time, you know, traveling internationally over the last decade in some, you know, fairly odd places at fairly odd times. I was in Kenya while the presidential election was still up in the air. And it was, so I got to watch that whole process from overseas, from the BBC and from the African perspective. I was in Kabul, or India while we were bombing Kabul. So a couple hundred miles away, and I was facilitating a meeting of artists from throughout that region. So I had people from Pakistan and India and Sri Lanka and other things.
Wow.
So some of what I want to look at is just a way of kind of processing that in my poetry, which I haven't done. Processing, and particularly kind of in a post-September 11th world, that seems to me important to look at, because I'm not convinced that we as Americans have actually learned anything at all about anything about the world, other than world bad, bad world.
Yeah.
Don't blow up buildings. Since September 11th, I don't see that we've completely, really, integrated the idea that other people might think differently than we do, and that might be legitimate.
Well, I hope your new writing experiments go well, and that you have a fantastic time in Thailand.
Well, it's hard not to. It's a wonderful, wonderful place.
And good luck with your projects.
Thanks.
Thank you again, Joe, for participating in the MSU Libraries Michigan Writer Series, and good luck with your reading tonight.
Thanks for asking on both accounts.
Okay.